Well, welcome to Food Conversations, Season 3. Now, Food Conversation is a program about food in all its aspects, from planting seeds to growing, harvesting, distributing, and eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shuswap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shuswap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Before we continue, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkrepmuk people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility. Today, it is my pleasure to welcome back Samantha Gambling, Provincial Coordinator of the BC Chapter for the Coalition for Healthy School Food. Listeners may recall that Sam was on Food Conversations a few weeks ago, helping us to discuss the Salmon Arm School Lunch Program. Welcome back, Sam.
Thank you. Hi.
Delighted to have you here once again. And we're going to give you center stage as we go through today's program. By the way, I understand that the City of Salmon Arm has just formally endorsed the Healthy School Food Program. That's the case, I believe. Is it not?
Yeah, that's right. It's exciting to have Salmon Arm as an endorser of the Coalition for Healthy School Food. And that was in large part thanks to Serena and the Shuswap Food Action team. So that's great.
Well, they have been the originators of our Food Conversations program. It came from Melanie Bennett, who's the secretary of the SFAS. So we're very happy and we're very deeply involved with the work of the Food Society. Mm-hmm. But today we're going to talk about your work with the Coalition down the road. But for now, I'd like to bring you to our listeners as Sam the person, looking at the trajectory that got you to your current work. As listeners to the show who listen more than once, they'll know that the trajectory of the person that we're interviewing is very important because it shows, especially for young people, it shows that you don't have to have things all worked out when you start out. You don't leave school and go straight off and figure out exactly what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And, of course, guests have interesting stories to tell about what brought them to the place they're in today. And I think our listeners will find that you're no exception to that rule. So, we're launching. You're a North Vancouver protege. That's where you started.
Yes. Yeah. Born and raised in Vancouver. Very, very fortunate to have grown up in North Vancouver, in the unceded Squamish territory. And had such a lovely childhood with the forest in my backyard.
You talked about the forest being in your backyard. Did you interact with the forest in your backyard? Some people say, "Oh, there's bears out there. You better be careful." Mm. You know.
Oh, yeah. No, our elementary school, I think, was quite unique in that it didn't have, it did have a playground, but it also, the forest was the playground. So I remember playing games in the forest and we had the creek there and you couldn't go past the creek, mind you. But we did have a lot of freedom to explore, the forests and all the huckleberry bushes and everything that was around there.
Do you remember what you really liked about that? What you liked about the forest? What drew you to it, made it sort of a special place for you?
I just remember it being so magical, especially in the spring. There was something, through my childhood eyes, it was just so amazing to see the magnolias bloom in the spring and then the chickadees come and we have a birdhouse. And it was very serene and peaceful and I felt very connected to my little backyard and the whole like grouse woods area that I grew up in. And
how far away was the creek? I'm just trying to figure out how much room you had to roam.
Oh, the creek was, so we had a little backyard that had a lot of magnolia trees and pussy willows and ferns and then we had a fence. And then you open the fence and the creek is right there. So there was literally it was right there. It was very close. I remember wandering down the creek and with my friends trying to collect tadpoles or whatnot.
So you could go sideways, but you couldn't go straight across.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You also had animals inside the domicile. You had animals in your home. And that was sort of a feature of your life as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely a huge animal lover, and a lot of my work stems from my love for animals and compassion for animals and focus on animal welfare and animal rights and animal relations. I grew up always with three cats and a dog. At one point, we had four cats and a dog, and that felt like a lot. So
that could keep
three cats and a dog. It was
that's outnumbering the humans at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
I understand at one point you also had fish.
Yep.
And your father apparently had birds. What kind of birds did he have?
Oh, I can't remember now. I think they were canaries or something. My dad, for most of my life, has lived in San Diego. Mm-hmm. And when we would go down and visit, we would see his birds. And they also have corgis. But yeah, I can't quite remember what kind of birds they were. They did sing, though.
They sang. The singing birds.
Songbirds.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I think, if you recall correctly, you said that your first ambition, if you're going to, when you grew up to, you know, be in the adult world, that you wanted to be a wildlife biologist.
Yeah, I wanted to be a wildlife rehabilitationist or rehabilitation specialist. Mm-hmm. And for a while, I worked at the SPCA and as a humane educator. Mm-hmm. And then I remember one time taking the kids to go to Wild Arc on Vancouver Island.
Okay.
It's a rehabilitation center for wildlife. And I remember going there and being like, oh, this is eventually where I want to end up. And then I smelled the raccoon cage. And I was like, oh, I don't know. This takes a lot of grit that I'm not sure I have. So my mind changed at that point to like maybe being less hands-on, but also ultimately supporting animals and the wild ecosystem and anything that I do.
I guess it shows that we all have a way to interact with what we love.
Exactly.
It doesn't have to, not everybody has to do it the same way.
So much power to those people. Respect.
Who muck out the cages.
Yeah.
So in school, in high school, did this kind of percolate through you, your schoolwork, you know, when you were still at school, were there things that you did that caught your interest and stirred your consciousness?
I'm not sure I was really focused in high school on what happens after high school. I think I was a classic teenager. I mean, not to say that all teenagers are not focused on what they want to do, but at that point, I think I was really interested in what I was doing at school. I was really involved in the school plays. I had my extracurricular activities. I had, of course, all of the drama that goes along with being 16. And
I never heard of that.
I think I knew I wanted to do something around animal welfare. At one point I thought maybe I wanted to go into teaching. I actually can't put myself back in those shoes and remember exactly what I thought I was going to do afterwards, except that I just wanted to do something I knew that I was going to enjoy.
Yeah. Then you left school and, and went off to UBC and took your undergraduate degree. I guess that would be a BSc or?
Yeah, it was a BSc and it was actually at UVic. I did my undergrad at the University of Victoria.
Okay.
And so, yeah, moved to Victoria, which was just far enough away from home that I didn't have to go home and was close enough that I could go home if I wanted to for holidays.
Sounds like classic state of mind of a
exactly.
young person. I don't want you. Well, actually, could you help me with this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So grateful to my mom. When I was 18, moved to Victoria and I did my undergrad in combined biology and psychology. And actually the first year of my undergrad, I remember going through those at that point. I don't know if it was all online, but I remember having a book that listed all the classes at UVic and I was flipping through the book, circling the ones that I was interested in. So my first year, I did some very random courses that didn't really lead to a degree at all. I was just like, I'm going to do what's interesting to me. And so I remember a food, nutrition, and health course. I took a bunch of psychology courses. I think I took an acting course. I just, was trying to figure out what exactly I wanted to do.
Which is a really good thing to do, as opposed to just plunging in and say, I better get started on this because my future depends on it, that kind of thing. And it's something that a lot of kids these days don't do. They get scared. They get worried that they won't have a future, you know, materially. And so they end up taking courses they don't necessarily want to take. They just feel that they're going to give them some security. So you didn't. You wandered the intellectual realm of university in the first year or so. And then you started to focus on, obviously, the biological sciences and psychology. How did you find that kind of linked together in your own mind?
Firstly, I went to, I think, the university center, and I said, what can I get a degree in based on my courses? And they were like, okay, well, this is the one that works. So it was combined biology and psychology, biopsych. And there was, I mean, I found that super interesting because there was a lot of brain and behavior courses. I could integrate animals into that really easily. So I took a really interesting neuroethology course where I learned about the behavior of animals and the brain chemistry and circuits that are working when animals behave in a certain way. And I was able to take animal behavior courses, ecology courses. So it really connected my passion for animals in the natural world. And then also, my interest for biology. And I found psychology really interesting in the sciences. And I remember doing a psychological statistics course. And so it kind of led to this research component too. And it just all kind of connected in my mind in terms of how we are behaving, why we are behaving the way we are, and how can we maybe even make changes to our behavior to better our world.
And in fact, animals and we are quite closely linked when it comes to behavior in many ways. We have common patterns. A project you did doesn't sound like it was directly connected to either psychology or biology, because it was studying the longevity of deceased sticklebacks from Haida Gwaii. Why don't you tell listeners how that happened?
Sure. Yeah, it was in ecology. So my supervisor, my honors supervisor, Tom Reimkin, is an ecologist and lived part-time on Haida Gwaii. And so he had collected these three-spined stickleback samples, I think from the 70s, I want to say. I don't want to date him, but I think from the 70s. And then he had put those samples in formaldehyde and brought them back to the lab. And my job was to basically cut off the pelvic spines of these stickleback and do like thin slices and look under a microscope at the cross sections of these pelvic spines. So one of the three spines of a three spine stickleback, and then count the growth rings, like the annuli of these spines to understand.
Like a tree.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was one hypothesis of how you could tell how old fish are is by counting these annuli. So I was able to count them and understand how old they were, and then see whether or not the larger stickleback lived longer than the smaller stickleback. And it was all part of this fly now, die later hypothesis. But it was an ecological honors project. And unfortunately, I don't remember a ton about it, except that I spent a lot of time in the lab looking under a microscope.
Tell listeners, how old can a stickleback be? That sounds like a beginning of a poem.
I should have read my dissertation or
is it years or is it months or is it days?
It's years. It's years. I remember, I think it was probably maybe 6 years was a pretty old stickleback. They're a really interesting species because they're found circumborally around the earth. So they're both freshwater and saltwater, and they live in brackish water too, I believe. So they're like a well-studied species. Yeah, I definitely learned a lot there. I also learned that I don't love research.
Something good to know.
Yeah.
Besides the sticklebacks, you also did another project involving traveling to Malaysia. That sounds like every student's dream.
It was, yeah.
To travel far and to study our cousins. Tell listeners about that particular project.
Well, so that was part of a field course. So it was tropical field ecology. And I think we spent, I could be wrong here, but between 2 to 6 weeks, maybe 4 weeks in Malaysia. And yeah, it was an amazing course. And as part of that, I just remember doing a research project where I focused my project, I think, looking at the psychology of, or specifically like mirror neurons, I want to say, which is a type of cell. The thing is, I'm not in biopsych anymore, so I could be completely wrong saying these things. But as far as I remember, I was looking at mirror neurons in great apes, and I thought that was a really interesting way to try and advocate for animal rights and animal welfare by trying to, you know, quote, prove that animals had sentience or the ability to identify themselves. And looking back, I mean, that's not the way that I would go about it anymore, but I thought at the time that was a really interesting perspective.
Well, it would have nailed it down for you. It would have made it seem like anybody who says there isn't sentience is probably missing the boat. They're not understanding what animals are really like. The primates in that part of the world would be orangutans, and but. We'll leave the exact cousins involved to some.
I wish I could tell you more. It was a very powerful experience, but the details are blurred at this point.
Well, why didn't you tell us what made it so powerful for you?
One of the things, so I remember, there are a couple of moments that really stick out in my memory. One of them was visiting the palm oil plantations in Malaysia, and there's a lot of deforestation that that is due to palm oil plantations, and there's a lot of then elephant-human interactions because the elephants are losing their territories, not just elephants, but lots of different animals are losing their territories, and so they are encroaching on human settlements. So that was very powerful because we got to visit a plantation and see firsthand and learn from the farmers as well. And like, this is their livelihoods. And there was just so many indications that that something in the system is broken, and it's not at, you know, the fault of Malaysian farmers. It's there's a systemic issue here.
Indeed. And we play a role in that because we like our palm oil to use for industrial purposes and all that kind of stuff. Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you said there was a couple of it. There were other kinds of experiences. That was one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another one that comes to my mind is that we were in, I'm not sure I've ever told anyone this, but we were in a mangrove ecosystem studying the mangrove forests. And there was this beautiful, I mean, it was so pristine and beautiful. And then there was this kind of river or stream that came through where we were staying. And there was just a lot of garbage in the river. And I was like, hold on, this is supposed to be like a protected ecosystem that is, you know, quote, the most pristine, one of the most pristine places in the world. And there's garbage here. So like, if there's like, really, it occurred to me that just how much we are polluting our world. If, you know, if I'm finding wrappers and things like that in this beautiful spot, then just what else is, just was a click in my mind.
Well, it's something that I think more and more people are coming to understand. They see seagulls who have died on Midway Island with a stomach full of plastic. They see animals from the ocean and from land that have been, have been both whose habitat has been destroyed, and they themselves sometimes have been and been deeply affected in terms of their health and survival. Yeah. And I remember you said something to me when we were talking before the show, the program. You said that you were interested in animal welfare, but with domestic animals in particular. You said, my heart would break every day if I was doing that work all the time. It sounds to me like that really is something that touches you, that really it's not just an intellectual interest. It's something deeper and broader than that.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just an intellectual interest. It really is kind of where my heart is. And like I was saying to you earlier, I thought maybe I would be a vet or a wildlife rehabilitationist or work directly with animals in the environment in some way. And I'm just not sure that I have like enough grit or like To be able to handle sick and dying animals every day. So I had to figure out, once I finished my undergrad, I had to figure out how exactly do I want to help animals in the best way that meets meets my strengths and what I can actually support with, and isn't going to really hurt my heart. So eventually, I decided, at that point I was doing some kind of humane food projects just on the side. And I thought that farm animal welfare was kind of the pathway I wanted to go. I also at that point had read Jonathan Safran Foer's book, Eating Animals, which was really, at that point in time, really powerful for me. And I hadn't realized animal agriculture and kind of what that entails. So I decided farm animal welfare was what I wanted to focus on. And through food, you can touch so many different aspects of life. It's not just animal welfare. It's everything. So that was a really exciting.
At one point, you actually contacted the well-known Australian bioethicist, mm-hmm. Peter Singer, who's a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. And you asked him, what should I do? Where should I go?
I don't know. Just to clarify, I don't know Dr. Peter Singer
at all.
But I did send him an email. I'm not afraid to reach out to people who I don't know. So
you didn't
I sent
phone him
an
up
email. No, but I wasn't expecting to hear back, but he very kindly replied. So my email said something like, I have an opportunity to go to grad school. I don't really love research or but I'm not sure which way I should go. Like, would it be better for me to help animals by working at the grassroots and doing, some of this grassroots advocacy and stuff? Or would it be better to get my degree and try to work from the top down? So what would be better, bottom up or top down? And he said, whatever you want to do is helpful, but we always need more people at the top. And so that kind of helped me make my decision of it wouldn't hurt to get this master's degree and try and support animals from the top down.
Peter Singer's stamp of approval was placed on
you. Yeah, exactly.
Which is pretty significant. So you went to, this time you did go to UBC and mm-hmm. the Faculty of Land and Food Systems and you started there and mm-hmm. went into... Well, talk about what you got into the material there in particular areas.
Yeah, well, I actually started at UBC not through, I guess this is even prior to being offered a master's position, but I went to the UBC farm and I did my practicum in sustainable agriculture. And that, again, was a really transformative experience. And just having that hands-on experience, being able to support food production and what goes into that and being a part of that community at UBC Farm was incredible. And from there, it led into my master's in land and food systems.
Listeners should know that the UBC farm is the only working farm within the Vancouver city limits, and it has therefore caught the eye of many people. At one point, there was a move to turn it into high-rise apartments, and there was such a huge outcry of resistance to that. I don't know if you were aware of that or had followed that, but it is a very special place, and it now supplies mm-hmm. a ton of food for students on campus. I've eaten at some of the campuses' restaurants, and the food is absolutely wonderful. It's fresh. It's the best you could get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have a great chef and a great system. Yeah. Yeah. So from UBC Farm, I went into the Faculty of Land and Food Systems, and my supervisor, Dr. Hannah Whitman, was an incredible mentor, and she was my co-supervisor. So I also had another co-supervisor, Kent Melanix, who was at KPU.
My goodness. Yes, he's mm-hmm. very well known in BC now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So Kent and Hannah, that was a powerhouse. And I studied food sovereignty and agricultural policy. And in particular, I studied the supply management system in the BC dairy industry and was able to compare that with the kind of agricultural policy or that lack thereof in New Zealand around the dairy system there.
I looked up Hannah Whitman's brief bio online mm-hmm. for the faculty, and it says her focus is the ways that the rights to produce and consume food are contested and transformed through struggles for agrarian reform, food sovereignty, and agrarian citizenship. It sounds like a heady mix of, excuse me, of politics and policy making and on the ground activity, you know, what farmers do on a daily basis. That must have been
very well said.
Well, she said it, so
she did.
That's why it's well said.
and she does research internationally, so she conducts a lot of research here in BC as well as in Brazil.
Yes,
and other areas. Yeah,
and food justice, to just use a single term, is something that became part of your thinking and your awareness of food and its role in society.
Yeah. So, I mean, food justice, food sovereignty, food literacy, these were all new terms to me going into my master's. And I learned a lot, both from Hannah and my colleagues and my other professors, as well as I was a TA for the undergrad series, Land and Food Systems series. And honestly, I feel like that should be a required course series for everybody, because I think I was TAing for maybe a couple of years, and I learned so much from those courses, just around systems and our food systems. What are our inputs and our outputs? Who are the stakeholders, and what does that actually mean?
There's an old saying that if you want to learn, teach.
Teach. It worked in this case.
It worked, yes, very well.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit about the difference between New Zealand and Canada, and I know that especially in BC, the supply management system for dairy in BC is widely respected. It's considered sort of a fairly optimized way to manage supply. And you found that New Zealand, although their technical side was quite sophisticated, their sort of overall policy and organization was not. That it wasn't as the BC had a bit of a leg up with respect to that kind of approach.
So I was looking at agricultural policy and its impacts on food sovereignty principles. And so in particular, I looked at kind of the economics principle and how stable the system was for producers' incomes and how they, like what their perspectives were. So really I was interviewing dairy farmers in both BC and New Zealand and getting their perspectives on whether they had economic stability and resilience and sufficiency in order to do their daily activities,
sure.
As well as environmentally, what the kind of the big concerns were or what, you know, they were doing in terms of that, politically, whether they had a say in their policymaking at all. So I was asking these dairy farmers these questions. And in New Zealand, because they don't really have any policies now, it's really a free market system. There's huge peaks and troughs when it comes to the kind of the boom and bust of the dairy industry. And dairy is notorious for having these booms and busts in terms of like what dairy farmers are able to receive for income. So
sure.
At the time I was visiting, dairy farmers were really concerned because they weren't earning enough in order to keep their farm sustained. And I need to go back and take a look at it again. But essentially, the supply management system supports food sovereignty principles in a more stable way than the New Zealand dairy system does a number of reasons.
I've heard it's the envy of some of the other food commodity producers.
Oh, for sure.
Like to have that. Well, all good things must come to an end, and your master's degree was in hand, and you had to decide what to do next. And I can imagine from what you've just said that your mind was full of ideas for reform, for change, for you know, doing something different. And you discussed this with your co-sponsor, Hannah Whitman, and because you didn't know what to do, and she gave you some advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had asked to think at one point whether or not I wanted to do a PhD, and I just find the academic sector so difficult. Like, I really don't like writing papers. I love the interviewing part and the field work, but I just find the academic piece very difficult. So at that point, I was like, no, I really don't want to do a PhD. And she gave me some great advice, which is, you know, do the work that you want to do. And once you get to a question that you can't answer, that's when you can use your PhD as a tool to answer that question. Sure. And I thought that was a really great way to frame it.
And so away you went. And as I understand it, one of your first initiatives after your master's was to start the BC Tiny House Collective. Now that sounds to listeners a little bit like it's branching off, especially if it's a tiny house in a tree. How did that tie in? How did that tie in with what you'd been doing up to that point?
So I should say that things happen simultaneously. So while I was, I'm sure we'll get to the PHABC part, but while I was applying for work, I was also trying to find stable housing in Vancouver. And as everyone knows, that is very hard to do. So I was looking at alternative housing options, and this was at the start of kind of that tiny house fad. So I was very inspired.
There's still tiny houses out there.
There definitely is. Yeah, no, and it's not, it shouldn't be a fad. It should really be a housing option for people who feel like it works for them. So I think I watched a documentary called We the Tiny House People, and I was like, oh yes, that's what I want to do. So I am very, you know, spontaneous and will jump on opportunities sometimes. And so I bought a trailer and started building a tiny house, not knowing where I was going to put it. And then realizing that tiny homes are illegal in most parts of BC. And
really?
And that led,
like all over BC?
In most parts. It's based on the municipality, both zoning and building bylaws. So it got quite technical. And we met with a lot of municipalities. My friend Anastasia and I started the BC Tiny House Collective, and our goal was to normalize legitimize and legalize tiny homes as an option amidst this housing crisis for anyone who
wanted. So what you found was that there was a size limit, and it was a lower limit. You couldn't go below a certain size. You had to build a size bigger than that.
So it depends. Yeah, that was I think there was only one municipality where there actually was a minimum house size, but more so it was the fact that they're on wheels. It was that there's no tiny house building code. So you can build them to RV standards or CSA certified RV or mobile home standards. But then a lot of zoning bylaws don't allow for RVs or mobile homes within the city limits. So there was a bit of a tricky thing there for a lot of municipalities, even those who thought that it was a good idea. So it's just I think ultimately we ended up putting forward some recommendations to the BC Building Code to try and get a tiny house building code standard. Right. I know a lot of people are still working on this, but eventually I had to bow out because we were doing a lot of work and not getting paid, and I had to focus on my actual job. So
so then you moved on to Small Housing BC.
Yeah, I worked for Small Housing BC for a little bit, and we did kind of a missing middle project for housing, like the missing middle of housing, and we talked to a number of municipalities. I think the city of Nelson and City of Maple Ridge we talked to, and yeah, we're looking at alternative housing options.
So Small Housing BC was another organization?
It's a nonprofit.
And you sort of morphed or were absorbed. Was the Tiny House Collective absorbed into this Small Housing BC, or you just let it go?
Formally, no, but we were connected with Small Housing BC, the ED, and super nice guy. And then he invited us to work for a couple of his projects. So, yeah, so it kind of morphed in there.
But obviously this acquainted you with the fact that there is regulatory stasis, that regulations can be established because it seemed like a good idea 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 10 years ago. And when you run up against it, there's this momentum that you bring, but it meets this resistance from not ill-defined or ill-intentioned regulations, but just simply they don't they don't reflect what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, regulatory stasis is a good way to put it. So there were definitely those, what we called political barriers or regulatory barriers. But then another big one was cultural barriers. And that's something that has kind of stuck with me for a long time in many different parts of my work is that we have the culture right now in Canada is kind of this, I don't know if I'm going to be overstepping, but it's like capitalist, neoliberal, consumerist culture that we are living in. And that causes, that's like the root of all of our, a lot of our issues.
I'm afraid to say colonial culture.
Colonial
culture. I think terms like that are entirely acceptable. And I don't think
are welcome. Okay, good.
You will not have a listener pushback against that. You'll actually hear a lot of people saying, they probably have their thumbs up in the air right now saying, capitalist neoliberal.
Exactly.
There's a general sense that there is a transformation in social values and cultural values going on right now. And it's very profound and it's very, in some ways, very disruptive, but it's disruptive towards a better way of doing things. And I think the things you're talking about are very much in that direction. Mm-hmm. Speaking of transformation, around this time, and I'm thinking it was about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 or 8 years ago, you attended a conference that really turned you around, and that was the Food Secure Conference in Halifax. What happened there?
So it was during my, I've attended a couple of Food Secure Canada conferences, and I found them really powerful as it was my first conference I attended as a grad student. And so I was presenting some of my supply management research, and it was just kind of the first time that I stepped into this world of food security and food sovereignty, academics, activists, and citizens in Canada, and seeing this amazing community. And I knew that was the people who I wanted to be working with.
And it was also public engagement. You were presenting, you were sharing your ideas with a lot of people. And that obviously is something that has gone on progressively as time has gone by. So what do you take, as you sort of put yourself back at that conference in Halifax, what was happening inside you when you saw all these people talking about the needs that people have for food and how we meet those needs and how we work with one another or don't, and how we have to, you know, what went on inside you? Because it was a big deal.
Well, I think just inspiration, passion, confirmation of some of the work that I was doing and what I really believed in. And some of these conversations that were happening around food justice and food sovereignty and Indigenous food sovereignty, and not just our relationship with food, but our relationship with the earth and with each other as community members and with ourselves, our relationships to food and what that does to our own psychology. And it really brought all of these different pieces together.
You around this time, and it's clear, as I'm sure listeners realize, that there were things going on in parallel much of the time. The Farm to School BC organization became a presence in your life. How did that happen?
So once I finished grad school, I was applying for jobs, and the Public Health Association of BC, who runs Farm to School BC, so it's a program of PHABC, they were hiring a community animator for the Vancouver area region, which is essentially somebody who supports farm to school projects and does a lot of the connections and relationship building and supports policy and supports on the ground programming, and just is like this person who animates the community, which I really loved that idea. And there's this amazing community animator handbook for anyone who's interested from the UK. And it really defined what I want to be doing in life. I was like, yes, that's it. So I got the job as the community animator for Farm to School in the Vancouver hub. And I did that for about 3 or 4 years.
Describe a day in the life of a community animator. What I mean, obviously, I think listeners are probably realizing that you can be animated because of our conversation. But what was the centerpiece of it and the pattern of it that really caught your fancy?
That's a good question. What's the day in the life? It really varied. There's a lot of, so pre-COVID, there was a lot of events. We were trying to support knowledge sharing between school food stakeholders, for lack of a better word, between teachers and parents and students. And we were trying to build a network in the region and make sure that people had a way to talk to each other. There's a lot of projects happening in silos. And so once you have somebody who's like the connector, they're able to engage in more collective action. So then also identifying where that collective action could happen and new projects that could start up. We did a lot of grant writing to support programs and starting new programs. We gave out, so Farm to School BC gives out grants every year. So also supporting those recipients to engage in their programs and figuring out what they need in terms of support. You know, is there, you're really trying to get to the root of some issues and understand the successes as well and be able to share those best practices and identify ways to solve problems like systemically. So it's quite interesting. Yeah.
So a lot of it sounds like you were bringing people together who would not necessarily have realized that they were on the same track, but when you could say, well, they're doing this here and you're doing this here as well, why don't you start talking to each other? That kind of thing. You're not just animating, but you're also kind of helping to coalesce people working in this area so that they could have more of a collective voice as well.
Yeah, that's the goal. Yeah. And in some places, like Vancouver already had a really great network through the Vancouver School Food Network. And so I didn't have to obviously like start from scratch there, or there's some amazing leaders in the Vancouver region. So I was able to learn from them and understand how what they're doing could be brought to other parts of the region. And so we started up a North Shore School Food Network, for example.
So yeah. Going back home.
Exactly. Yeah. I spent a lot of time in North Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Did you go over the creek ever?
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah. We went over the creek. Yeah.
you were allowed as an adult to cross the creek.
Yes.
So in the midst of the Farm to School Public Health Association of BC work, the Coalition for Healthy School Food emerged from what was going on. How did that work for you? Like, how did that happen? How did you go into that area from the overall Farm to School?
So Farm to School has kind of three areas or I guess principles in their work. There's food literacy or hands-on food systems education. There's school community connectedness. And then there's healthy local food into schools. And so Farm to School at that point in Vancouver was really excelling at the food literacy part and the school community connectedness part. But there were lots of barriers in terms of getting healthy food like onto the plates of students in schools. And so I was just exploring kind of what opportunities there were. There were a lot of conversations around food procurement and school meal programs as part of the Farm to School world. And then I attended another Food Secure Canada conference where the Coalition for Healthy School Food was meeting, and this is the national coalition. And at that point, I think there were probably 30 to 40 members across Canada, and a few of them were from BC. And so I sat in on one of those meetings and realized, like, this is really the piece that's missing in my mind there within Farm to School is this, like, school meal program piece. And so I was trying to figure out how we could build some of this in BC, how we could contribute to that advocacy, and how we could advocate both provincially as well as federally.
So here's this nascent organization, Coalition for Healthy School Food, and there were people in BC who were involved. I understand that you had a role in kind of getting the BC, well, you got a grant to help to coordinate what was going on in BC.
So after attending that conference, I asked PHEBC to join the coalition, and so they became a member of the Coalition for Healthy School
Food. So they hadn't been part of that up till then?
No, we hadn't heard. I mean, the coalition at that point didn't have... It didn't have like a huge presence in BC. There were a few members, and it was really just getting started here in terms of building that membership. So I met with the other members of the coalition who were then kind of locally based in Vancouver. And we all got together and were trying to explore how we could build this provincially, how we could provide more support to the national coalition. And we decided to explore the concept of a provincial chapter of the coalition. And so I approached PHABC, the Public Health Association of BC, to see if they would be willing to host the provincial chapter. They said yes. And so I started applying for grants.
they would host it just if you
if build I can
it,
get the money.
If you build it, they will come.
Exactly.
So you applied for grants and you got a small grant initially to kind of get things started. How did that go? That just kind of got things rolling, sort of set up an office, set up some kind of protocol so that you were a legitimate person. How did that work?
It was I can't remember the name of the grant. It was a Vancouver Foundation grant, and I think it was kind of like a convene grant. So it was to bring people together to start having the conversations and figure out what exactly the next step is. And so we had money to bring people from across the province together for an in-person event to talk about what the strategy of a BC chapter could be, what types of activities would be best to engage with, what our kind of vision was, and to share best practices as well. It's always been about sharing and knowledge, knowledge sharing and capacity building and things like that as well. And so that, I think we had a year's worth of funding for that. And then I applied for the larger Vancouver Foundation grant. And just this past April was successful in getting 3 years worth of funding from the Vancouver Foundation. And that's been supplemented by a number of other funders and partners and donations from some of our members and endorsers. And it's been a collective effort for sure.
The idea appears to have gone down well with not just nonprofits, but also it's attracting some positive attention from in government circles, both from individual MLAs, but also has it been something you caught the interest of official government bodies?
So one of the first things we did as a provincial chapter was visit all of the political party caucuses and give a presentation about who the coalition is, what our collective vision for school food was, and ask them to support our work. And we got some multi-partisan support for a universal school food program and our guiding principles. And then there was the provincial election in October of 2020. And we did a bunch of advocacy emailing MLAs before that, or I guess during the election campaign. And we were really happy to see following the re-election of the BC NDP government that they included school food in the mandate letters of the Minister of Education and the Minister of Agriculture, Food and Fisheries. And so that was exciting because it's kind of like it's in their mandate now as something that they are directed to do over the next 4 years. So we were able to come in and say, how can we help you?
Were there differences in the kind of support you got from the three main parties in BC? Did they emphasize different parts of food security and food sovereignty and food in schools?
Surprisingly, maybe not surprisingly, but no, we really did have good reception around the idea of supporting like publicly funded school food programs from all of the three political parties. We in BC, and I think we're pretty lucky here compared to the rest of Canada in terms of that support. And we, I guess, so in the election campaign, it was within both the BC NDP and the BC Green Party platforms that they included this mention of school food. But we've met with the BC Liberals and had some really great conversations with them, and there's a lot of support for this. So the coalition is nonpartisan, and we really want to have this be just like a multi-partisan issue, a non-partisan issue. This is something that all students deserve, and that is a right, basically, for all children.
So nobody came on with the nanny state kind of rhetoric when you were approaching?
I didn't hear any nanny state rhetoric. No, at least not to my face.
Yeah, as soon as you left the room.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's something about food, perhaps it's a bit special. And it is that there's no way we can live without it. And it's hard to make it a partisan issue if it's making somebody better fed, especially children. It would seem if you couldn't get this across, you'd be dealing with a very hardened kind of resistance, which I don't think exists very, very much these days. The grant has led now, I believe, you've been able to hire an Indigenous lead short time ago. I saw the prospectus for a future Indigenous lead on the website of the TLABC, the PHABC.
The job description.
and it was quite extensive. And I mean, if I was applying for it, I might be a bit daunted, even if I was Indigenous. I would. I think there's a lot of work to do.
There is.
Where is your partner in crime now? Where is she, or he, I should say he or she, located? And how's that working?
Yeah, so we just hired Braden Etzerza, who's from the Metlakatla First Nation, I believe. And he is from Prince Rupert, I think located currently in Canmore, Alberta, but is hoping to come home at some point soon. So we hired him maybe in January, the beginning of January. And I'm kind of, it's an open position. It really is like whatever he deems necessary in terms of engaging with Indigenous school communities and organizations and supporting Indigenous-led school food programs and separate negotiations with provincial and federal governments. So I'm supporting him as much as he wants and needs. But at this point in time, he's making a lot of connections with Indigenous-led school food programs, both on and off reserve. And so I think is really open to meeting people at this point. He's doing kind of some storytelling in partnership with Farm to Cafeteria Canada, and is exploring doing a webinar later this spring to introduce himself and his work and to start making those connections and meeting people.
I noticed one interesting feature of the application request was that it said you can live anywhere you want in BC as long as you have secure internet connection. And I was thinking that that's become an issue in many communities that are outside the ambit of sort of southern BC, or, you know, the first 60 kilometers north of the 49th parallel. For many, many parts of Canada, that is a huge issue. Was obviously Prince Rupert probably has secure internet, but would this have meant that some people who wanted to apply as an Indigenous lead would have had difficulty just from that one thing alone?
I'm sure. Yeah, it's unfortunate. Unfortunately, that is the way that we're doing work right now, is over Zoom and is over emails primarily. We do have a travel budget, so this Braden can visit communities in person and can build relationships face to face. But of course, as well with COVID, that is becoming, or that is just precarious and really depends on the community's needs and feelings of comfort and safety. And so, unfortunately, it is stable internet is a need.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now we're coming, we've got about 5 minutes more, but we'll be talking in great detail about the Coalition for Healthy School Food in the next program. But I wanted to, when we were talking before today, it was clear to me as I heard you describe what you were doing that you have an open mind and variety of interests and a variety of thoughts about what's going on in the world. And I thought maybe we just end up with you saying some of the things about where you where you would go yourself. I mean, obviously you're committed, you know, for the 3 years, mm-hmm. and it's a very fulfilling job, and who knows, you might mm-hmm. be doing it 20 years from now.
Yeah.
But if you weren't, some of the things you mentioned were, again, getting into animal welfare advocacy, that's still a kind of a current that flows in you. Is that not the case?
Yeah, absolutely. I really love the coalition building work, and I love engaging with people and collective action. I find that really fulfilling, and this kind of solutions oriented. I don't know, that's probably pretty colonial, but you know, like this idea of working together to resolve problems or to make the world a better place or what have you. So I love that type of work, but I could really apply that to so many of my passions. And I think at one point in time, I'm already feeling tired of computer work. So it's like, how do I work more with my hands in the soil and in community? And so this idea, I've had a love and interest in death culture for a long time, like death and dying. And I think there's such a huge opportunity there to engage in death in a different way than our culture is used to. And in terms of sustainability as well, the idea of green burials, and there's this new human composting site in Seattle called Recompose, which is really interesting. And so it kind of ties in the sustainability and the human behavior and psychology and culture. And like, it's just very interesting to me.
I just learned that Salmon Arm has a new what do you call a place where you bury people?
Cemetery.
And I heard a woman say, they've stolen my nouns. And I know what she was talking about. and there is a space there for green burial. Mm-hmm. And there is some thought about it. And there has been some discussion about it on the Environmental Advisory Committee. So you're on the cutting edge of yet another issue that is important for us. I'm going to thank you very much now for being with us today, and that I'm looking forward to our next show where we'll talk at length about the coalition and your role in it. This has been really a delightful visit today on the radio, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much,
Sam.
For having me.
Delighted to have you.